Chapter 73. Nostromo had been growing rich very slowly. It was an effect of his prudence. He could command himself, even when thrown off his balance. And to become the slave of a treasure with full self-knowledge is an occurrence rare and mentally disturbing. But it was also in a great part because of the difficulty of converting it into a form in which it could become available. The mere act of getting it away from the island piecemeal, little by little, was surrounded by difficulties, by the dangers of imminent detection. He had to visit the Great Isabel in secret, between his voyages along the coast, which were the ostensible source of his fortune. The crew of his own schooner were to be feared, as if they had been spies upon their dreaded captain. He did not dare stay too long in port. When his coaster was unloaded, he hurried away on another trip, for he feared arousing suspicion even by a day's delay. Sometimes during a week's stay, or more, he could only manage one visit to the treasure. And that was all. A couple of ingots. He suffered through his fears as much as through his prudence. To do things by stealth humiliated him. And he suffered most from the concentration of his thought upon the treasure. A transgression, a crime, entering a man's existence, eats it up like a malignant growth, consumes it like a fever. Nostromo had lost his peace. The genuineness of all his qualities was destroyed. He felt it himself, and often cursed the silver of Santome. His courage, his magnificence, his leisure, his work, everything was as before, only everything was a sham. But the treasure was real. He clung to it with a more tenacious, mental grip. But he hated the feel of the ingots. Sometimes, after putting away a couple of them in his cabin, the fruit of a secret night expedition to the Great Isabel, he would look fixedly at his fingers, as if surprised they had left no stain on his skin. He had found means of disposing of the silver bars in distant ports. The necessity to go far afield made his coasting voyages long, and caused his visits to the Viola household to be rare and far between. He was fated to have his wife from there. He had said so once to Giorgio himself. But the Garibaldino had put the subject aside with a majestic wave of his hand, clutching a smoldering blackbriar root pipe. There was plenty of time. He was not the man to force his girls upon anybody. As time went on, Nostromo discovered his preference for the younger of the two. They had some profound similarities of nature, which must exist for complete confidence and understanding, no matter what outward differences of temperament there may be, to exercise their own fascination of contrast. His wife would have to know his secret, or else life would be impossible. He was attracted by Giselle, with her candid gaze and white throat. Pliable, silent, fond of excitement under her quiet indolence, whereas Linda, with her intense, passionately pale face, energetic, all fire and words, touched with gloom and scorn, a chip of the old block, true daughter of the austere Republican, but with Teresa's voice, inspired him with a deep-seated mistrust. Moreover, the poor girl could not conceal her love for Guy and Batista. He could see it would be violent, exacting, suspicious, uncompromising like her soul. Giselle, by her fair but warm beauty, by the surface placidity of her nature holding a promise of submissiveness, by the charm of her girlish mysteriousness, excited his passion, and delayed his fears, as to the future. His absences from Sulaco were long. On returning from the longest of them, he made out lighters loaded with blocks of stone lying under the cliff of the Great Isabel, cranes and scaffolding above, workmen's figures moving about, and a small lighthouse already rising from its foundations on the edge of the cliff. At this unexpected, undreamt of, startling sight, he thought himself lost irretrievably. What could save him from detection now? Nothing. He was struck with amazed dread at this turn of chance that would kindle a far-reaching light upon the only secret spot of his life, that life whose very essence, value, reality, consisted in its reflection from the admiring eyes of men. All of it, but that thing which was beyond common comprehension, which stood between him and the power that hears and gives effect to the evil intention of curses. It was dark. Not every man had such a darkness. And they were going to put a light there. A light. He saw it shining upon disgrace, poverty, contempt. Somebody was sure to. Perhaps somebody had already. The incomparable Nostromo, the Capitus, the respected and feared Captain Fidanza, the unquestioned patron of secret societies, a Republican like old Giorgio, and a revolutionist at heart but in another manner, was on the point of jumping overboard from the deck of his own schooner. That man, subjective almost to insanity, looked suicide deliberately in the face. But he never lost his head. He was checked by the thought that this was no escape. He imagined himself dead, and the disgrace, the shame going on. Or, rather, properly speaking, he could not imagine himself dead. He was possessed too strongly by the sense of his own existence, a thing of infinite duration in its changes, to grasp the notion of finality. The earth goes on forever. And he was courageous. It was a corrupt courage, but it was as good for his purposes as the other kind. He sailed close to the cliff of the Great Isabel, throwing a penetrating glance from the deck at the mouth of the ravine, tangled in an undisturbed growth of bushes. He sailed close enough to exchange hails with the workmen, shading their eyes on the edge of the sheer drop of the cliff overhung by the jib head of a powerful crane. He perceived that none of them had any occasion, even to approach the ravine, where the silver lay hidden, let alone to enter it. In the harbor he learned that no one slept on the island. The laboring gangs returned to port every evening, singing chorus songs in the empty lighters towed by a harbor tug. For the moment he had nothing to fear. But afterwards, he asked himself. Later, when a keeper came to live in the cottage that was being built some 150 yards back from the low light tower, and 400 or so from the dark, shaded, jungly ravine, containing the secret of his safety, of his influence, of his magnificence, of his power over the future, of his defiance of ill luck, of every possible betrayal from rich and poor alike, what then? He could never shake off the treasure. His audacity, greater than that of other men, had welded that vein of silver into his life. And the feeling of fearful and ardent subjection, the feeling of his slavery so irremediable and profound that often, in his thoughts, he compared himself to the legendary gringos, neither dead nor alive, bound down to their conquest of unlawful wealth on Azura, weighed heavily on the independent Captain Fidanza, owner and master of a coasting schooner, whose smart appearance and fabulous good luck in trading were so well known along the western seaboard of a vast continent. Fiercely whiskered and grave, a shade less supple in his walk, the vigor and symmetry of his powerful limbs lost in the vulgarity of a brown tweed suit, made by Jews, in the slums of London, and sold by the clothing department of the Compagnia Anzani, Captain Fidanza was seen in the streets of Sulaco attending to his business, as usual, that trip. And, as usual, he allowed it to get about that he had made a great profit on his cargo. It was a cargo of salt fish, and Lent was approaching. He was seen in trampers going to and fro between the town and the harbor. He talked with people in a cafe or two in his measured, steady voice. Captain Fidanza was seen. The generation that would know nothing of the famous ride to Cata was not born yet. Nostromo, the miscalled Capitus de Cargadores, had made for himself, under his rightful name, another public existence, but modified by the new conditions, less picturesque, more difficult to keep up in the increased size and varied population of Sulaco, the progressive capital of the Occidental Republic. Captain Fidanza, unpicturesque, but always a little mysterious, was recognized quite sufficiently under the lofty glass and iron roof of the Sulaco railway station. He took a local train, and got out in Rincon, where he visited the widow of the cargador who had died of his wounds at the dawn of the new era, like Don Jose Avellanos, in the patio of the Casa Gould. He consented to sit down and drink a glass of cool lemonade in the hut, while the woman, standing up, poured a perfect torrent of words to which he did not listen. He left some money with her, as usual. The orphan children, growing up and well-schooled, calling him uncle, clamored for his blessing. He gave that too, and in the doorway paused for a moment to look at the flat face of the Santome mountain with a faint frown. The slight contraction of his bronzed brow casting a marked tinge of severity upon his usual unbending expression was observed at the lodge which he attended, but went away before the banquet. He wore that at the meeting of some good comrades, Italians, and Occidentals, assembled in his honor under the presidency of an indigent, sickly, somewhat hunchbacked little photographer, with a white face and a magnanimous soul dyed crimson by a bloodthirsty hate of all capitalists, oppressors of the two hemispheres. The heroic Giorgio Viola, old revolutionist, would have understood nothing of his opening speech, and Captain Fidanza, lavishly generous as usual to some poor comrades, made no speech at all. He had listened, frowning, with his mind far away, and walked off unapproachable, silent, like a man full of cares. His frown deepened as, in the early morning, he watched the stonemasons go off to the Great Isabel, in lighters loaded with squared blocks of stone, enough to add another course to the squat light tower. That was the rate of the work. One course per day. And Captain Fidanza meditated. The presence of strangers on the island would cut him completely off the treasure. It had been difficult and dangerous enough before. He was afraid, and he was angry. He thought with the resolution of a master and the cunning of a cowed slave. Then he went ashore. He was a man of resource and ingenuity. And, as usual, the expedient he found at a critical moment was effective enough to alter the situation radically. He had the gift of evolving safety out of the very danger, this incomparable Nostromo, this Elo in a thousand. With Giorgio established on the Great Isabel, there would be no need for concealment. He would be able to go openly, in daylight, to see his daughters, one of his daughters, and stay late talking to the old Garibaldino. Then in the dark. Night after night he would dare to grow rich quicker now. He yearned to clasp, embrace, absorb, subjugate in unquestioned possession this treasure, whose tyranny had weighed upon his mind, his actions, his very sleep. He went to see his friend Captain Mitchell, and the thing was done as Dr. Monaghan had related to Mrs. Gould. When the project was mooted to the Garibaldino, something like the faint reflection, the dim ghost of a very ancient smile, stole under the white and enormous mustaches of the old hater of kings and ministers. His daughters were the object of his anxious care, the younger, especially. Linda, with her mother's voice, had taken more her mother's place. Her deep, vibrating H, Padre, seemed, but for the change of the word, the very echo of the impassioned, remonstrating H, Giorgio, of poor Signora Teresa. It was his fixed opinion that the town was no proper place for his girls. The infatuated but guileless Ramirez was the object of his profound aversion, as resuming the sins of the country whose people were blind, vile esclavos. On his return from his next voyage, Captain Fidanza found the Viola settled in the lightkeeper's cottage. His knowledge of Giorgio's idiosyncrasies had not played him false. The Garibaldino had refused to entertain the idea of any companion whatever, except his girls. And Captain Mitchell, anxious to please his poor Nostromo, with that felicity of inspiration which only true affection can give, had formally appointed Linda Viola as under-keeper of the Isabel's light. The light is private property, he used to explain. Tea belongs to my company. I've the power to nominate whom I like, and Viola shall be. It's about the only thing Nostromo, a man worth his weight in gold, mind you, has ever asked me to do for him. Directly his schooner was anchored opposite the new custom house, with its sham air of a Greek temple, flat-roofed, with a colonnade, Captain Fidanza went pulling his small boat out of the harbor, bound for the Great Isabel, openly in the light of a declining day, before all men's eyes, with a sense of having mastered the fates. He must establish a regular position. He would ask him for his daughter now. He thought of Cassell as he pulled. Linda loved him, perhaps, but the old man would be glad to keep the elder, who had his wife's voice. He did not pull for the narrow strand, where he had landed with Deckard, and afterwards alone on his first visit to the treasure. He made for the beach at the other end, and walked up the regular, ungentle slope of the wedge-shaped island. Giorgio Viola, whom he saw from afar, sitting on a bench under the front wall of the cottage, lifted his arm slightly to his loud hail. He walked up. Neither of the girls appeared. "It is good here," said the old man, in his austere, faraway manner. Nostromo nodded. "Then, after a short silence, you saw my schooner pass in not 2 hours ago? Do you know why I am here before, so to speak? My anchor has fairly bitten into the ground of this port of Sulaco." "You are welcome like a son," the old man declared, quietly, staring away upon the sea. "Ah, thy son. I know. I am what thy son would have been. It is well, Viejo. It is a very good welcome. Listen, I have come to ask you for—" A sudden dread came upon the fearless and incorruptible Nostromo. He dared not utter the name in his mind. The slight pause only imparted a marked weight and solemnity to the changed end of the phrase. "For my wife." His heart was beating fast. "It is time you—" The Garibaldino arrested him with an extended arm. "Hat was left for you to judge." He got up slowly. His beard, unclipped since Teresa's death, thick, snow-white, covered his powerful chest. He turned his head to the door, and called out in his strong voice, "Linda." Her answer came sharp and faint from within, and the appalled Nostromo stood up too, but remained mute, gazing at the door. He was afraid. He was not afraid of being refused the girl he loved. No mere refusal could stand between him and a woman he desired. But the shining specter of the treasure rose before him, claiming his allegiance in a silence that could not be gainsaid. He was afraid, because, neither dead nor alive, like the gringos on Azura, he belonged body and soul to the unlawfulness of his audacity. He was afraid of being forbidden the island. He was afraid, and said nothing. Seeing the two men standing up side by side to await her, Linda stopped in the doorway. Nothing could alter the passionate dead whiteness of her face, but her black eyes seemed to catch and concentrate all the light of the low sun in a flaming spark within the black depths, covered at once by the slow descent of heavy eyelids. "Behold thy husband, master, and benefactor." Old Viola's voice resounded with a force that seemed to fill the whole gulf. She stepped forward with her eyes nearly closed, like a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.